Hey there, it's Farah. Before we get started with this episode, I want to set the stage just a little bit. This conversation was recorded last Friday, July 19th. After the debate, after the weeks of controversy, after the failed assassination attempt on former President Trump in Butler, Pennsylvania, but before President Biden took the decision to step aside from the campaign and endorse his vice president, Kamala Harris. We're living in those weeks that seem like years. And while in many ways the world completely changed just days after we recorded this conversation, what we discussed is maybe more important now as we move forward through the next 100-odd days to the election on November 5th, as it was last week. This episode runs a little longer than most, so we're not going to have any little interstitials or anything like that. Going to try to get straight into it, but I promise you will get so much out of it. It is decidedly not about polling. In this moment of uncertainty, I felt like the best thing for me to do was invite an old friend of mine, David Gartenstein-Ross, and his colleague Amal Ali of Valens Games, to talk to me about immersive strategic games and the role they could play in helping campaigns, parties, and really leaders of any kind, engage in the kind of exercises they use to help organizations better understand competing interests and objectives, opportunities they can take, threats to guard against, and just work through how they plan to sense and respond to the uncertain days ahead. If anyone listening is interested in working with us or Valens Games to plan and execute this kind of immersive exercise, you can reach out to me at farah@crosstabspodcast.com, or you can get in touch directly with David and Amal through their website at valensgames.com. That's spelled V-A-L-E-N-S games, all one word, .com. With that, we're going to take you straight into the conversation. I hope you enjoy it.
I'm David Gartenstein-Ross. I'm the founder and CEO of Valens Games, a private firm that uses immersive exercises to help produce better insight about the world, and also has a digital platform that allows rapid creation of games that can educate, train, and help provide insight.
And how about you, Amal? Tell us a little bit about yourself.
I'm Amal, and right alongside David, I am happy to be the Senior Vice President of Strategy at Valens Games, and my primary focus is strategy in terms of engaging primarily with the government and the public sector.
So maybe a good place to start is just to talk about how Valens Games came to be.
Valens Games originally sprung out of another organization I founded called Valens Global. I founded Valens Global almost a decade ago now, on August 1st of 2014. My background is that of a subject matter expert and analyst working on issues of violent non-state actors, so terrorism issues and the like. I founded Valens in part because I felt that the field I was a part of could be doing something different. I wanted to build a place that had greater intellectual freedom and was able to look around the time horizons that then tended to dominate the field. It's a great organization. A retired colonel, Derek Jones, now runs it. One of the things I saw it as was an incubator that could stand up innovative new lines of business that themselves would be investable businesses. And Valens Games was born in that context. The idea for games, on my part, came out of a class I was teaching at Georgetown University. I realized that my students were looking for something that was more tactile than what they were accustomed to in our classroom discussions. And so I started building these simple games, and relatively quickly, my class became one of the most popular in the security studies program. What I found is that everyone I talked to about using games for class was really interested in. And it wasn't long before I started to run my first professional games. Now, fast forward a little bit, and I started to understand in this field in which people were routinely using games for education or the professional wargaming, I came to understand what was missing. I realized that they could be done differently, and in difference, something better could be created. And that's where the idea of an immersive exercise, which is our own style of gaming, came from. To me, what was different than the rest of the field is there is a way to take strong professional games that can either train or educate or teach you something about the world and make them compelling experiences, which I think they should be, with no kind of disrespect or shots taken at other games that are out there. I think that a game should be every bit as fascinating and multi-layered and murky to navigate and fun to navigate as the real world is. We should be able to confront major issues related to the election or to climate change or to great power competition or to terrorism in a way that draws us in and makes us understand the many facets of the issue that we're looking at. Mm-hmm. So our immersive exercises are characterized by world building, character development, narrative arcs, all of which is a difference than what's out there and a difference that we know from the surveys we take post-game that our participants really appreciate.
Amal, how did you come to be involved in this? What was your path into this type of work?
My way into Valens Games was by way of the military and my friendship with David. So my background, I am a military veteran. I have experience in the intelligence community at the agency level and alongside providing support to Army and Joint Special Operations. So with that, I knew that intrinsically that there was a need of understanding what we call and talk about often as second and third order effects, right? So we look at it as like consequences and tertiary outcomes that we need to consider before making a decision. How do you conceptualize this in a common form? And so the military talks about wargaming all the time. And, you know, it's something I've always cared about, especially as an intelligence analyst. If I'm making a decision, how can I discuss the outcome, especially since it's going to have national security, national level impact? It can impact the lives of people that I know, people that are on the ground, people that are using my intelligence. So fast forward, I haven't been in the IC intelligence community in 5 years. I was doing consulting and I met David in the irregular warfare community and we started talking about it. And he told me about his work in the wargaming space. And he invited me to one of the exercises, immersive exercises held by Valens Games. And I was smitten. In fact, David, if you don't mind me telling the story about my husband.
Please.
So my husband was away for work. He's also in the military. And he had a couple days, a little over 24 hours to come home and spend some time with me and then go back. And it was the same day as David's game that he'd invited me to. It was at 7 or 8 in the morning, super early. It's a Saturday. My husband's coming home. I need to leave Sunday morning. So I was like, well, David's hosting a war game I'm invited to. Do you want to go? And we go. This was our date. Right? He's not at all for any more time than that. And we spent our day playing this game and it was the best experience I'd ever had. And it's not even a selling point. It was how I was sold on to it. And I remember on our drive back to our house, he's like, this is the best thing I've ever done. And he's also in the military special operations community and his ideas were sprawling about. And I just remember telling David, I'm like, David, this has so much potential. I don't think I can even begin to conceptualize the impact this can have. So I was honored to, you know, follow, lock and step behind David and take this where we can.
That's an amazing way to spend your 24 hours also. I'm just, so well done, David.
Yeah. It was, one, it's a testament to just like how big of nerds we are, but also just, you know, hey, care about David. How do I have the best of both worlds? So it was a win-win for me ultimately.
I think it might be helpful for those listening and also just for context's sake. This conversation in some respects comes from Ezra Klein. So Ezra wrote a piece in, I don't know, late February or something, definitely before the State of the Union speech. So whenever that took place, and I no longer remember when that was, but he had written a piece suggesting that President Biden may not be the best candidate for the Democrats to run and that the Democrats should consider replacing him with somebody else. And there was a lot of Sturm und Drang about that, of course. My reaction to it was a couple of things. One was, it seemed in the argument that he was putting forward that he was basing that conclusion on polling and kind of exclusively polling. which is fine, but limited as a data source. When you then start to think about the opening up of the complexity of taking a sitting president, not having him seek re-election, doing it 10 months out from an election, but still quite close. I mean, the concept of short and long elections is very warped in my mind. My husband is English. Their elections are 6 weeks long. Ours seem to go on forever. So
day after inauguration, the next campaign starts.
Exactly. So like, what is short? What is long? I don't know. But, it, you know, there are a lot of moving parts to all of this. And there's a lot of things that struck me as being taken a bit for granted about how comparatively easy it might be to replace the presumptive nominee at any point in time, but that it would matter very much when and also where everybody else was. And that it was also not a question solely for the Democrats, that there are multiple parties involved here. And then even beyond that, the typical framing of the conversation was either one that looked as if you could hive off just the Democratic Party and its supporters and reckon with the implications within that universe, or maybe you would have someone who would think about how the Republican Party might respond. But that also seemed to be kind of a local limit for understanding the overall system that would be involved in making such a decision and going into a convention-based choice of who the candidate would be, something we haven't done since the reforms of the early 70s. And that also seemed naive to me. So as I was sort of thinking through the kinds of work that I've done with clients, you know, I started to think like we wouldn't focus group or survey our way to an answer about this. We would engage some kind of scenario planning exercise to think through all the implications, how that would impact different parts of the business, how competitors might respond, what that would mean for product and marketing and operations and everything else. And so I started casting around for, did I know anybody who did that kind of work in the political space? I'll candidly say the answer was not really, no. And so I did talk to someone who does wargaming type exercises for technology companies who are engaged in kind of product development and startups. And it was an interesting conversation. And then literally I was scrolling through LinkedIn that evening, and I think it was the day that, David, you announced Valence Global. So I was like, oh, I do know someone who does this work, not in like political campaigns, but who is in it very deeply and could talk to me about this. And so we had an initial conversation just about, you know, what you were up to and all of that. But I think in the meantime, the State of the Union happened. The conversation seemed to die down about whether or not we would have this kind of massive disruption. And now, obviously, it is a live discussion. And so what I wanted to do here, since the primary purpose of Crosstabs has been to talk about the way that campaigns, pundits, politicians, pollsters, journalists, everybody are interacting around primarily survey-driven data about the campaign, about the candidates, about the electorate, that it would probably be a good time to start talking about other ways we might understand complex problems. Because anyone who's worked with survey instruments for as long as I have knows that it's never really a complete picture of people's mental models, the way they'll ultimately behave, the whole universe. Like if you tried to write a survey instrument that covered all the things you'd need to cover, you'd never be able to afford it because the survey would be an hour long and you'd have to pay people $100 to complete it. And so like this is just not practicable. And also that it just is very hard to survey things that a voter can't know. Like sometimes these questions are not for the voters. They're for thinking through all of the other kind of implications of it. We're not even just talking about US actors here. We're living in a globalized space. We're living in a digital space. Lots of people are influencing information flows and how people understand what they're seeing. And so what I wanted to do really was talk to some folks who are experts on how these types of tools work, to just talk through A, how they work and what they're typically used for. And then just at a very high kind of structural level, how they could apply to the political sphere. Because I will tell you in the interim, every guest I've had on the show, I've asked if they're aware of any campaigns using these tools. And so far, no one has been aware of the use of these tools in this space, which sort of surprises me, given the complexity of the work of running campaigns and given, you know, how things have evolved, particularly over the last 10, 20 years with social media and everything else. So that's my big sort of context setting. But I think the thing I'd like to just sort of start with is you know, my earliest exposures to wargaming and scenario planning were fairly limited in their application. It was kind of academic applications, military or intelligence community applications. And then on the scenario planning side, kind of commodities-based businesses with fairly large threat vectors. So oil companies, you know, like Shell. Mm. Shell is well known for, I think it's Shell, for doing massive scenario planning exercises. I am curious about the origins of this practice and maybe just why you think the world of users of this practice stayed where it has been up to this point, why it's been kind of more focused in military, IC, and academic practices. So I think that's three questions, but I don't know, either one of you want to take a stab at it.
Yeah, so I'll take a stab at a lot of that. The first thing is we don't really use the terms that you used on the regular. And it's not because they're not applicable, and it's not because they're not used. But it's because people sometimes get the wrong idea about what you're doing if you use the term like war game or scenario planning. Mm-hmm. And the reason I start with language is because I actually don't think the niche is confined to what you're talking about. I think that this is a very expanding market, one that's big now and is going to be much bigger in the future. Where the market is now, I think that you correctly speak about a few different spaces, but I'd go beyond the traditional DoD-focused space. In the U.S. government, some sort of game or immersive exercise is employed not only in the DoD, but we've designed exercises for the State Department's Foreign Service Institute to help people who've just completed courses there to really make sure they're conceptualizing the complexity of relationships that exist, for example, in the Middle East region. Mm. I've seen other use cases in international institutions that have included the Global Counterterrorism Forum, where we've designed games as a tool to help in the formulation of best practices or policy toolkits. We've recently completed a game for Canada's Department of National Defense looking at cooperative action to address climate change. These are all different areas where use cases have existed. And I'm certain that Nike employs games as part of its business practice. Hmm. In that games are not just about, you know, threat or physical risk or supply chain disruption. They can be used to help to conceptualize entry to a new market. They can be used to game out cultural controversies and the impact on a customer base, which is something obviously that Nike and recently Adidas will weigh into or stumble into intentionally or not. These are all areas where games can be useful. Turning from terminology and level setting to the utility of games, you asked about the origin of the practice. In part, the term war game comes from a 19th century German game called Kriegsspiel, which was used to train the German military and to help them conceptualize on a strategic in strategic matters. But like, let's leave aside the ancient history. In recent years, we've seen two different trends, which I think are driving the market space I identify. We could add a few other more recent trends to that, which help to make Valens Games what it is. But one trend is the increased complexity of the world in which we're all operating. You have a greater degree of interconnection and greater emergence of truly global problems, which people have trouble conceptualizing ways to stumble through or ways to address. In parallel to that, you've had this massive breakthrough in video games. Video games have gone from being what we're all familiar with from the 1980s and 1990s, from Atari to Nintendo, to becoming legitimate works of art. Mm-hmm. There's a lot going on with games. And so immersiveness is naturally a space that people are looking to provide them with some insight. So the final thing, going back to where you and I started this conversation, Farah, you talked about, you know, Ezra Klein's idea for an open convention. And obviously, when you and I looked at the column, the first thing we thought of is, well, there's a lot that's missing here, right? It seemed this very, you know, there were a lot of assumptions made. And there was this assumption of a fairly banal process of choosing the next Democratic nominee out of an open convention. Mm-hmm. But, like, let's not get into a debate with Klein here. Instead, no. I think this is a good way to anchor, and I know that's not what you were doing, but it's a good way to anchor what the value of a game is. Mm. We've seen people change their minds based on games, and the reason why, it's the difference between presentation of multiple arguments. We can present multiple arguments about what Ezra Klein was missing when he wrote his column, but really, if you go through an exercise and have to wrangle with and live through the consequences of having suddenly an open convention in 2024 with the Democratic Party being as fraught and fractured as it is, then that might change your mind about the assumptions that are being made in that column. One could, of course, say, well, no, this X, Y, or Z in the game might not have happened. But in presenting it in such a tactile way, where you're living the consequence, I think that lessons and causality and consequence can be far better understood from a game than they often can be through debate and discussion, where people just tend to double down and try to factor things away. When you're in kind of a simulated reality, that can be much harder to do. No longer are you the master of the argument. Instead, your argument has to meet the world.
Yes, this is actually the crux of what I wanted to talk about, is so far the conversation around these systems feels very modular. It's like, if I just take out this piece and I replace it with another piece that's more or less the same shape, then the machine will still work in the way that we previously conceived. And yes, when we were talking about that, I think that was really the thing I was trying to reckon with, was this seems messier to me than that. This seems like there are more moving parts here, more things to consider, more parties and counterparties than are being factored in. And they all have sometimes overlapping, sometimes matching, sometimes competing interests. And those things also have to be factored in. I think even one of the things that we discussed was the idea that because we used to have a convention-driven process for selecting candidates of both parties, that people would just happily default to that method of doing things. You know, we did it in 68, so we can do it in 2024, setting aside that 68 was a pretty messy year for that type of activity, and that part of the reason that in 70, 71, 72, they changed all the rules because they did not like that way of handling things. That is a kind of questionable assumption. Like, you'd want to test that out and see how different groups of people would respond to that. You know, maybe older people would be more comfortable with it because they remember when, whereas in my lifetime, that has not been how candidates were selected. The other thing that I've been thinking a lot about the last couple of weeks as the conversation was revived were things like, so here's my slightly silly example. The argument that, well, we can't do this because they can't move the money that has been pledged or donated to the Biden-Harris campaign. And, you know, my immediate reaction to that is just to say, you can always move money.
Yeah.
Money can always be moved.
Absolutely.
That is the thing about money.
Yeah.
Is you can move it. But then I started to realize that some of the conceptions about this, first of all, were just kind of lack of granular knowledge about how, like, the Biden Victory Fund is a cross-committee PAC. So there are multiple parties to it, and it's a super PAC, and so it is not constrained in the ways that the candidate campaign fund is. So it's sort of a technical issue of, like, let's really get people more acquainted with what the actual structures and rules are. But the other part of it struck me as just a mindset problem I don't know if this is the right phrase for it. That the harder shift for people to make is going from what we've had for the last 60 years, which is the candidate is the leader, back to the party is the leader. So in this example, if for some reason, you know, we ultimately get to a place where
Biden steps down, it's relatively easy for Harris to inherit that money. If Harris also decides she doesn't want to pursue the office, then it'll be a little bit messy. There'll be some donors who want their money back. They've got to pay their vendors. There'll probably be some lawsuits. But most of that money will just get assigned to the DNC and other super PACs. And then that changes, however, the kind of locus of control strategically over what happens next. And that's like the next step that I haven't seen any public commentators start to think through or talk about. It shifts the whole dimension of how you are assessing the possibilities when you start to look at the bigger, more complicated system. And I think your point about getting away from just, and this is very funny since we met doing speech and debate, but like getting away from doing just the presentation of arguments. And I love sort of the idea of being the master of that argument and factoring away all objections into something more grounded and immersive is the thing that it feels like if they're not doing it, they should be doing it. And I'm just kind of curious about how you create those types of experiences so that people are grounded and immersed.
It's a great question. There's a lot of different ways to design, but the area where the secret sauce resides for us is the fusion of granular expertise with creating a compelling experience. And so I want to talk about those both briefly in turn, and then I definitely want to kick to Amal, because the symmetry between Amal and I here is, you know, this is a technique that I developed over the course of about a decade. I can speak to it as a designer. And as Amal has put her finger on, she can speak to it as first a participant. And more recently, you know, she's done work on the design side and has actually, for one of our upcoming games, is playing a lead role in putting a game together. But often she'll have experience as a role player within a broader game that someone else has designed. So she has some other modalities of relationship with it that I don't. But on the one hand, with subject matter expertise, there's a wide variety of inputs that you can intake. Some of them can be more traditional modeling. Some of them can be people who have institutional experience with, you know, an aspect of, say, an agency that we're working with or with a region that we're examining. These are all areas where subject matter expertise can play a role. The bottom line is that every part of a game needs to cohere to someone who knows the thing itself. Right? So like, Farah, you and I both, as you mentioned, we met in high school debate. If we have a game about high school debate, which gets kind of basic facts wrong, right? If it has, you know, for the era that we were in, if there's cross-examination debate and it's a one-on-one, like right away we would understand that there's a problem with that. Or let's say that they're modeling kind of the state that we grew up in, and it's a game about that state, and they pronounce it Oregon, right? That's like this yeah, that's a tell right away.
Right.
That no, you don't actually know Oregon.
Yeah.
And so that's one aspect. The second aspect is, how do you make it a compelling experience? And there's a lot that goes into that, but the way that I tend to do it is, a lot of our games are strategic level, meaning that the players are part of an actor. It might be the U.S. State Department. It might be the Russian Federation. It might be Google or Meta. But they'll be part of an actor in the game world. And they'll intake information in the game world in the same way they would in our world. So we have, you know, public news feeds, which include social media posts, oftentimes video, news articles, and the like. And there also will be memos that they have access to that other teams don't. And it's taking all of this information with kind of the various points of view. There'll be very opinionated tweets. There'll be newspaper articles. Some of them will get facts wrong. Some of them won't. And it's very much like what we deal with day to day. And it's the fusion of those two, and it's making the information environment everything that it is to us, right? So opinionated, snarky, oftentimes inaccurate in important ways, personality driven, and emotional and fraught. All of that makes the game real and interesting and compelling and gross at the same time, which is what we're looking for. That's the kind of experience we get with the real world and the kind of experience someone should have in a game environment. So I think that hopefully that the fusion of subject matter expertise and a compelling experience helps to answer a bit of that question. But as I said, I think Amal can speak to this from another and a very valuable perspective here.
Yeah, thank you so much, David. I would like to first just tell a quick war story, and it's from my time in Afghanistan. Sitting in the air-conditioned government-built facility, and it's nothing like the adversary that we're dealing with outside, right? You go outside and you can smell tires being burnt alongside human organic elements, and it's just thick in the air, and that's what they're using for heat. Yeah, so the juxtaposition of two worlds. It was David and Goliath in some ways, right? And just a little bit of background, too. Ethnically, I'm Somali, right? So there's that story there of first us in the U.S. as U.S. Americans in Afghanistan fighting the Taliban, and then Americans in the early 90s in Somalia, where you have these what some would consider strategically challenging, but in some ways strategic failures in our end state. Our capabilities were outsized compared to the adversary. And so what I'm trying to get at is General Mattis had a saying, the enemy has a vote. And H.R. McMaster sums it up with strategic empathy. Having the ability to cognitively understand and play with and grasp that you may not understand how the enemy is going to react or feel about you. You have to understand that they are driven by the same human motivators that we're driven by. And something that Valens Games does right is that world building. The way the military currently war games is hex and counter. We have all of our capabilities. And in the world that we built for ourselves, how do we defeat the enemy? Answer, easily. Always. We built the world, right? It doesn't have the stake of the enemy. And sometimes we can use predictive analysis and statistics and the numbers. The numbers will, in some ways, do whatever we want them to do. Much like money, data, we can have them do whatever we want them to do. But the game captures the human element. And that's what I got to experience as a person playing this game, was the idea of now looking at this problem set in this world that was built by our creative team as a human being with the same stakes as an adversary. And I'm playing it out until the end. And then now it just clicks in my head. Now that I'm back to the real world and I'm back as an American, I'm not playing as, you know, the Chinese or the Russians or whatever, what have you. It's this obvious fact that we all know, which is we're all humans trying to fight for stakes, but sometimes we really get lost and lose that strategic empathy. And that's what Valens Games captures. So how this ties back into the election is sometimes we get so tribalized and localized in our view of ourselves, the good guys, because everyone's always occupying the moral high ground. We're looking at them, those guys over there. And we did it in Afghanistan. We did it in Somalia. But we need to go outside of that and realize everybody's occupying the moral high ground and understanding what their moral high ground is and looking at it as that Venn diagram. And that's what strategic empathy allows you to do. So I hope that all kind of captures that, the magic of, it sounds pitchy. I'm not trying to pitch, but this is a pivotal change that this game made for me as a person and trying to understand problem sets that we're kind of trying to figure out in our heads.
Right before the official beginning of the pandemic in the U.S., I went to Ottawa and gave a talk to the Bank of Canada about decision making, because I'd previously given a talk at a data conference about basically the idea that it is possible to make a good decision even if it doesn't turn out the way you hoped. And that in the world of kind of marketing analytics and market research, and clearly also in the world of polling, there's a lot about trying to make predictions about what's going to happen. You know, we're not really very good at that. We're okay at it, but not really very good at it. Actually, Aaron Zittner from Wall Street Journal, who runs their polling project, talked about the thing that he likes best about conducting polls is that it is an opportunity for him and his team to understand how the electorate is changing far more than it's useful in predicting the outcome of the horse race. And I think that's super interesting. Obviously, you know, they try to augment that not just with the surveys that they partner with outside firms to conduct, but also then interviewing people and going and meeting with them and that kind of thing. But the other part of this that I think a lot about is the desire to get the outcome you want can lead decision makers to do things that
they wouldn't look back on and say, I made a good decision, right? They made a series of decisions that they thought were necessary in order to get the outcome that they wanted. And, you know, if they get the outcome they wanted, maybe they can retroactively justify the things that they did along the way. On the other hand, if it doesn't turn out the way that they wanted, then they may look back on all of those incremental decisions with some regret. And so they were quite interested in that idea. And one of the things that I used as an anchor for that talk is a paper I read when I took a decision-making class in the political science department as an undergrad, written by my professor, John Orbell, who is now passed, but brilliant guy. He wrote an article that I think was called Rational Decision-Making Under Stress or Under Duress. The example he used was Hamlet, kind of lays out this question for him. He has imperfect information. His data source is a ghost. Either he saw the ghost or he didn't see the ghost. Either the ghost is really his dead father or it's the devil come to tempt him. And there are high stakes, right? If his father was in fact murdered, then he owes it to the state of Denmark to do something about it. If his father wasn't in fact murdered, then if he acts anyway on this information, he'll be committing treason and will be, you know, damned to hell. Like, serious stakes, highly emotional decision, imperfect information. And he has his ways of trying to figure out what to do. And in fact, kind of runs a game, right? He gets the players to reenact what he thinks has happened and then enlists his friend to watch everybody's responses to see if they look guilty, right? So he's running a little experiment to see if he can figure it out. But that kind of idea has always, particularly because I am a qualitative researcher, I think I am more exposed to the emotional elements of decision making than if you're just asking batteries of questions in survey data. And I think this is this idea of the enemy has a vote and strategic empathy, which I have heard both of those before. That ability to understand that the decision, like even talking about it as emotional and rational isn't quite right. To your point about everybody is occupying the moral high ground, you have to understand what that high ground is, you know, where they are positioned in order to have the perspective that they have. That is the thing that I think people struggle mightily to do, and that polling simply doesn't get you there. Like, I suppose you could do some polls to inform it, but it's not going to get you to that place.
No, it's funny, Farah. I love this direction of the conversation. And one thing that's interesting to me about the direction that we're taking is we've focused on perspective as point of view, which is important and a part of it that's very powerful. But I think another aspect of when you occupy high ground or have a certain perspective, you see things differently, not just values, but also opportunity. And to me, I think that in addition to being able to build, you know, cognitive or strategic empathy, looking at strategic opportunity is also a part of this.
Mm.
To me, that's part of what was missing when I looked at Ezra Klein's column. Let's say I'm looking at this from a number of different perspectives, an open convention. Let's say I'm looking at it from Russia's perspective. I'm looking at it from the perspective of, say, conservative media. I'm looking at it from the perspective of, say, groups that are dissatisfied with the direction of the Democratic Party and you believe that there are existential reasons that it should be pushed far to the left. Let's say just taking those three perspectives, for example. When you look from that perspective and look at an open convention as an opportunity, what do you see? What tools do you have? And perhaps those tools are not consequential enough to change the outcome of an open convention. But I think that's part of what arises when you put it in a game. You're not just looking at kind of the basic question. You actually are given actor capabilities, motivations, and you get to game out, what could I make of this opportunity? And so I think it's both empathy and a perspective that provides a greater sense of how available tools might intersect with what happens in the world that suddenly can produce something that's transformative in terms of your understanding of what the actual impacts of an event might be.
One of the things I'm curious about there is how you get people into the perspective so that they can start to identify opportunities if they are not, in fact, the actor that they're role playing at.
David will give a more fleshed out answer, but I'll sum it up in a story. So we ran a game recently at a nonprofit, and it was a very scaled down, more of a leisurely game. And before the game, we have everybody in the room and they're chit chatting. And there was this one woman in the audience, and she stuck out to me it was in DC, very DC after work. You could tell she didn't want to be there, but was there just to, you know, show up and rally. She did not want to be there. She was texting the whole time, just was not about it. At the end, one of the opposing teams that was her team's main rival had done something egregious and we'd never heard of. And it was just, if it was in the confines of the game, and it was very geopolitical and very apropos. And she herself, when she realized this had happened to them and they were so betrayed and violated.
Wait, let's actually say what. About, let's actually say
you
what
want me
happened,
to say it?
Because
okay.
it's so wonderful.
So she was in Team USA, so they were playing as the White House, and there was Team Russia that was playing as the Kremlin. And one of the players in the Kremlin had come up to me as a role player and said, hey, can we bug the White House? And I said, hey, life, limb, or eyesight, as long as no lives are lost, it's not illegal in the real world, go ahead, you can do anything in the game world. So they go and they drop in and they're running a live surveillance operation, and they have somebody listening in and essentially doing signals intelligence. In the game, they put in a phone that was mic on. At the end, they went and collected their bug. And so the U.S., the specific woman, just looks at them collect and she screams. It was this guttural human scream that I've only heard in an operational environment or like the hospital. I'm like, what's going on? She was like, did the Russians bug us in a way that you would hear in a skiff, right? And I look at her, I'm like, are you okay? She's like, did you guys condone this? What's going on? And that right there, the light bulb hit. And that's when the pieces connected for me. Like, that is strategic empathy. And that girl worked on the Hill. And she, at the debrief, was so boilingly mad. She went from sheer apathy, didn't want to be there. We said the sprinklers went off. She'd have been happy to leave that second. Till the end, stayed after everybody left to reconvene with everybody and talk to them. And I just remember her looking at me. And I was like, hey, it's just a game. And she was, but it felt so real. Mm-hmm. It felt like I was personally spied on. So that's just an example of that playing out. But Debbie can kind of get into the intricacies of it.
That's amazing.
No, and I think, Amal, that really actually answers the question so well. That illustrates every point I would make. It's not that people come in and you've waved a magic wand in some way so that they step in and right away they understand the actor they are and the opportunities and the like. Instead, it's that if you run it well and the opportunities align, you've created a team packet which shows the incentives of what they're trying to do, then as they immerse in the experience more, it becomes real.
Mm.
Like, that's the answer, that you run it well and soon it becomes real, but it's the experience that does it. It's by crafting a compelling experience, not by having some magic read ahead that can suddenly make people fully understand the actor. And that's why I think creating a compelling experience is so important, because it's the experience itself that makes it real.
I mean, the thing I think about here is reading commentary, listening to both political operatives and the pundit class. I think there is often, and you know, frankly, I encounter it in my own business, where the typical thing that happens in my work is we recruit a group of people who fit a certain set of profiles as prospects or customers of the company that I'm working with, people who are actively or even kind of peripherally involved in a particular market category. And we get them into the room, or we get them into the interview, we get them into whatever sort of exercise we're asking them to do. And the easiest thing for my clients to do in order to opt out of listening to them is first to find some fairly arbitrary reason why this person does not fit the profile that they were looking for. Even though they shop the category, they buy the products, they're familiar with the brand, they're absolutely in the customer base. But like, well, that's not what I was picturing when I imagined my customer. And so I don't want to listen to what they have to say. My worst case example of this was for two companies were thinking about engaging in a joint venture to make a bottled iced tea product. This is extremely high stakes, I'm sure you can appreciate. And we were doing ethnographic interviews with women in the South to see how they culturally interact with iced tea. And we had recruited people who make their own and have their own, you know, special recipe and do things in the old fashioned way, or the way their mothers and grandmothers did it. And then we also talked to people who very happily buy bottled packs of, you know, Snapple or whatever at Walmart or Sam's Club or something. We got to one woman's home, and the agency that I was working with literally didn't like the way she looked. Like, she wasn't cute enough. My whole job is to, like, just drop myself down into empathy with every person I interview. And so that was deeply offensive to me.
That's terrible. Did he verbalize that? I'm curious.
They did not, thankfully, in the interview with this person. But the second we got in the car, they told me that. And they were so vehement about it that this was not going to do. They did not want this person representing their customer base, that we had to very quickly.
Oh my God.
The only way to describe it is recast and find a young, pretty woman who buys gallons of iced tea from Sonic. You know,
the jokes write themselves.
Yes, they do.
You know, and of course, she's also in the audience set, but she's not on the more affluent end, which, given the price point they were exploring, they'd probably need to be at. There's a reason she buys it by the gallon from Sonic as opposed to buying it by the bottle at Walmart. And in any event, like, it was just this very total wall up of, I don't need to listen to this person because I don't like the way they look. Other times it'll be, earlier today, I was interviewing someone and the clients immediately got very worried because she expressed an interest in a particular product line that they don't currently offer. But that was one of many interests she had. She was sort of shopping around within the universe of things that they do make. And nevertheless, we would learn quite a bit from her. So that's the way that it shows up for me, is this, I don't have to listen to you because you don't fit my model of who you're supposed to be. Much less, I'm even going to try to see the world from your point of view. It's extremely interesting to think about that woman if she had been asked to play Team Kremlin.
Wow.
What would she have done in that set of circumstances? And I'm curious about, like, how do you get people into character when it's not their natural allegiance? I'm asking for myself.
Ooh, that is... So I have a guess, and this is coming from outside of the design perspective. So I'd love to hear and pass to David to get his thoughts. So from my perspective, from a personal end, right, I'm Somali. I lived around the corner from that fated day that, you know, the Black Hawk was shot down and my family was terribly impacted by it. Everything we've ever known, gone. And then we wound up in Denver, Colorado, of all places. But that's another story. I wind up in the military and I'm a native Somali speaker. I grew up Muslim. And so I have this dual experience of my household being Somali and the outdoor being American. And so I just have these innate understanding of, you know, being deployed back in Somalia of all places. And just looking at them, like, how do you not understand why they're not doing that? So there was that perspective of seeing just things that are very obvious and just human nature to me, just not communicating to the people that I'm working with. They're like, well, why would they want four wives if they're poor? And I'm just thinking, okay, I'm not going to get into that. But in this game, as the player, what I realized is people got the freedom to not have their own personal identity. We gave them permission to put their identity on pause. So because they entered this, like, threshold, I mean, be at the doorway, something allowed them to take a pause or a break from their very tightly held identity, their values and all of that. So because they knew it was a game, they almost gave themselves permission to not have to be themselves, knowing that their real identity, their real core values, their real operating system was not really at threat. And that's when they could really fully embody this person. So it's like acting, but it's different than acting because they weren't acting. They got into it. But that's because of just that threshold that the doorway created. I don't know what created it, but that's my guess at least.
The story that you provide there, Amal, is so powerful. The background you provide is so powerful. And I think that there are some game design ways you can also get at that. So the main thing that you're asking for is, how do you get people to just drop their inhibitions?
Yeah.
One thing that we use is role players, meaning that for the Russia team, very frequently towards the beginning of a game, they'll get a briefing from someone in their intelligence services or someone in their bureaucracy, which, look, a lot of our games are run at like universities. And so, you know, given how higher ed is, it's always a little bit toned down compared to the level of cultural disjuncture you would get. Because somebody who's interacted a lot with, or just had to, at points during my career, had to brief Russian officials who are visiting the U.S., they ask questions that are very different. And having like a role player who can help jog them a little bit out of their ideological priors can be part of that. Another thing we could do if we have a great deal of concern is you can often have like a mole on the team. Not meaning a literal mole in this case, not someone who's like a double agent, though we do that in some games. But having someone who is maybe affiliated actually with the gaming team, but is there kind of as though they're a player on a team, just to help provide that nudge to kind of get into character and get into perspective. So there are little things that you can do if you have concerns. But I actually find that, as Amal said, people embrace that freedom to be out of their normal role pretty quickly, because not only is it liberating, this is one of those areas where what people naturally do in the game intersects with something that is so helpful in one's professional life. To be able just to drop your ideological priors entirely and try to embrace a somewhat different perspective, I think that could be very important. You know, Mal put her finger on her background in the intelligence community and in the military. Those are both areas where just being able to drop your priors and kind of understand a radically different perspective can be super useful. For me, during the course of my career, that's been the thing that's most important to producing an actual kind of innovative breakthrough, including some of the breakthroughs we had in the gaming space, is just stop inhabiting the way that I tend to look at the world and try something radically different than what I might be inclined to do. Important skill, and one that I think games can very naturally cause someone to inhabit.
So one thing I would like to add to that, you spoke to it, but just to label it, is it allows us to take a break from cognitive dissonance.
Yeah.
It allows us to, you know, as they inhabit that world, those stakes and the resources and all these issues that they're grappling with in the world are not forced to be juxtaposed with their own intrinsic values and resources. They get a break from cognitive dissonance, and we know how powerful and just overwhelming cognitive dissonance can be on somebody's decision-making process.
You are labeling something I have been, and it is the better term than what I've been thinking about. So there's a recurrent set of questions that get asked in the presidential polls this year, and they reflect what I kind of keep calling disbelief. And it's this, you know, all other things being equal, I would rather not vote for either of these guys, right? I would like a different set of choices. You saw in the first few months of this year and most of last year, a real kind of, you know, they would sometimes ask, do you think these are going to be the choices? And you had very high numbers of people saying, no, I don't think these are going to be the choice. I think I'm going to have some other set of choices. Sarah Longwell at The Bulwark does these focus groups and they'll play audio from them. And really up until probably March of this year, there were people saying, is it really going to be Biden and Trump? Is that no, that can't be right. And this kind of, I just don't believe that that's going to be right again. Like, you know, I think some of it's that.
We've watched this show.
Exactly. I'm sick of this show already. But it just kind of disbelief that that will be the ultimate choice. And then I think we've now shifted into a different group of people having a different sort of disbelief, which is the disbelief that it's possible that one of those choices might change. I think you have a kind of permanent disbelief that one of the candidates will never become what we think of as a traditional candidate. Like there still is this kind of yearning for Trump to be normal. And it's like, I don't know, you got 8 years of proof that he's just not, like him or hate him, he's not normal. So in the sense of what we know of politicians. No. And that cognitive dissonance thing, I think, is just, that is what I'm thinking about. It's this, how is it possible that those people over there think that that's okay? How is it possible
that that's where they're coming from. How is it possible that they could do that? You know, it is part of our cognitive development to get from the point where we're babies and are able to say, oh, you're looking that direction, I'll look in that direction. Oh, you don't see things the same way I do. Oh, lots of people don't see the world the same way I do. To being able to engage in perspective taking. A lot of what this, you know, is sort of sounding like is an invitation to take perspective in an environment that feels immersive and real, but also is somewhere in your mind, you know, it's low stakes. You know that as a result of whatever it is you're doing today, no one's actually going to declare war on anybody else.
Yeah.
And that's that break from, as you put it, that break from cognitive dissonance is so interesting because I think it's very fatiguing for people and very stressful for people to constantly be living with the cognitive dissonance of sort of disbelief that other people don't understand things the way they understand things. And it can be very frustrating, yeah. I imagine, as they try to navigate complex decisions.
What you said is very profound. This again. And I think this less about the game and just like from a human perspective, I look at what's happening in America from a more different place than most people. I wasn't born here. I came here. I had a country fall to clanism and people that are decidedly all Somali, ethno-homogenous, fighting one another. And, you know, it's just ridiculous. It's like, why are you destroying your own country so I can be right? And there's something to be said about the power of fear, because ultimately we're all people. And it's the same base drivers that are motivating all of us across languages, geography, doesn't matter, fear. Of fearful people at any level, for any reason, their decision-making process is very interesting. And they go into fight or flight mode. I don't know, and I'm not making any conjectures here. I don't know if both parties understand how much fear-based marketing has completely warped our nervous system in this country. Ever since 9/11, and it's not a party thing. It's just, it's a pervasive social phenomenon that's been happening in the West, especially in the U.S. America's been constantly put in a state of fear for one reason, be it marketing, education, doesn't matter. Everybody is being pushed into this state of fear and terror and being told, and that's why we need to do this.
Yep.
And once somebody's afraid, you can tell them that we need everybody take drugs or drink this flavor aid. It doesn't matter. Once you tell them you have every reason to be afraid, do this now, people will do it.
Yeah.
I don't know if the marketing apparatus, the media apparatus, powers that be understand maybe what that has brought us to today.
And what Amal puts her finger on, fear drives so much. It drives what we're supposed to think, what we're supposed to not think. It really does. If you think about kind of the social pressures of social media, of the professional consequences that can come of saying the wrong thing at the wrong time with people from a variety of different political points of view who've had severe career and personal consequences for saying the wrong thing at the wrong moment. And that's always existed to some degree, but it's accelerated. Like everyone who touches the public sphere in any way understands that that fear exists. And that I think is part of also the value of GAMP. It puts you outside of the sphere of fear, at least momentarily.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes by putting you into a very different point of view, it makes you kind of automatically drop it. Meaning that if you're playing, you know, if you're a Russia team, if you are playing a terrorist group, you're going to see the world radically differently. You're going to have to in order to play successfully. And there's a lot that comes from the game demanding that you inhabit that perspective and making clear that there's no fear involved in doing so for the duration of the game.
This is particularly interesting to me in the political context that we have. And your point, Amal, about the warping of our nervous systems feels especially present after what happened last weekend. One of the things I have noticed people commenting on is how nonplussed the public discourse was after a public assassination attempt of a political candidate.
Yeah.
And some of that feels like, well, gun violence eventually will come for us all. Like, I don't know. I don't know how much of that is the case, how much it felt like, well, of course, we're living in this heightened environment where everybody hates everybody else. Eventually, something like this would happen. I mean, over the course of the last 8 years, the number of people I know, right and left, who have remarked about, well, not even the last 8 years. I mean, there were people in my circles who all through the Obama administration were low-key terrified because of who he is demographically and America's history with, you know, lynchings. That how is it possible that this guy can survive 8 years without someone trying to kill him? And of course, you know, people did. But there is something about this kind of warped. I mean, we keep talking about everyone's brains being broken since the pandemic. But I think you're right. I think it goes back farther than that and has been around longer than that. And the way the marketing works to leverage the fear is particularly interesting. And I, again, this is years ago now, but I worked on one of the HPV vaccine marketing campaigns years ago. Mm. And we did all these focus groups, all these interviews with people. And there's just sort of an initial problem, which at the time was getting people to understand the idea that viruses can cause cancer, which just wasn't people's mental model. Cancer is hereditary or environmental. It's not viruses. But then you had this other problem, which is that it's an STD. Mothers in particular, we're talking to moms of young girls, would have this rationalization of, this won't happen to my daughter. She's a good girl. It's skin-to-skin contact. It doesn't actually require intimate contact. It just requires skin-to-skin contact. Your daughter may be the best girl in the world, but one of these days, she's going to have a sexual encounter. And and so we kind of came back from all of this research and had this very awkward conversation. The real difference between mothers who absolutely want to get their children vaccinated and mothers who are on the fence, not sure, or resistant, is how scared of cancer are you? And so if we decided to scare people about cancer, we could probably get more uptake of this vaccine. But that is deeply unethical. And, you know, every HPV infection does not turn into cervical cancer. So this is high risk, but relative risk, not absolute risk. So how far down this path of freaking out parents do we want to go when most marketing to parents is about freaking them out? Like, do you want to pile on?
The bit I know about marketing comes from my time working with the Psychological Operations Unit in Army Special Operations.
You have the coolest career, Amal. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Amazing.
But it's true.
I was very fortunate. I was very blessed. But it was also one of the most fun things I've ever done. And one of the books that I had to read to just understand what they do was Influence. So that's completely your bread and butter, Farah.
Yeah.
One of the things that he explained that like really resonated with me was a three-part brain. When you have information that targets the amygdala, fight or flight component, you can get that person to make an immediate decision. But it's likely a fear-based lizard brain, I need to survive or procreate decision, and that's it. So you can get them to make that decision quickly without thinking about it. But you also don't get to control how they react to that decision that they made, right? You don't get to decide the second and third order effects. Whereas if you can talk to a person using logic, fact, they won't make a quick decision, but they will make a decision that you can understand and analyze what their second and third order effects will be after that, or decisions will be after that, because it's going to be a rational decision. It works on all of us. So for me, I'm a millennial. I remember the truth campaigns of cigarette smoking. And I remember this woman had like a laryngectomy where she had a hole in her throat.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my gosh, I just learned how to speak English. I can't have a hole in my throat. So I just remember developing this mortal fear of cigarette smoke. And it worked. I didn't smoke cigarettes, right? Mm-hmm. But now I have this visceral response to cigarette smoke that I really can't control. And there's like this judgment surrounding people that smoke cigarettes. And it's fear-based, right? So all the things tied to that fear are now tied to that thing I was motivated against. So I'm not a psychologist. I don't understand influence to that level. But there's something there to be said about using that tool of fear-based motivation very carefully, if at all.
So how do you think about that in how you design these immersive experiences? Because there's, you know, fear is going to be a response and a factor. And then there's also, like you said at the very beginning, that kind of grounding in things that feel right and true to people who actually operate in this space. I mean, what are some of the inputs? How do you get grounded enough to design the exercise so that people are going to do what they're going to do, but in a way that will feel compelling, immersive, real?
Well, I think that there's kind of an easy answer to what you're getting at, which is that in the exercises, of course, fear is a stimulus mm-hmm. because it isn't in our lives. That may seem to contradict what I was saying before, so let me actually explain it a little bit. Mm-hmm. Earlier, I said that you drop the fear you might normally have of thinking differently. And what I mean is that you're free to inhabit this role and to make decisions as though you're in this role as a different actor, and to see things that that actor, Russia or, you know, a terrorist group or the People's Republic of China or the U.S. State Department, you get to see through that particular lens without fear of taking on that lens. But the information environment, you know, the social media, the news and the like, there are elements of fear. There are elements of judgment. Everything that we experience in normal life is there and is represented in the game. And so to get at the question of the how, the answer is that it has to feel like our day to day. I talked to my team a lot about where to calibrate things. Generally, for a game, my own default setting is it's like day to day and turned up like maybe 8% to 10%, right? There's a little bit of exaggeration built in, but it has to be subtle enough to be largely indistinguishable. It's just designed to ratchet up emotional tension a little bit by having it be like normal life and put the dial up to 11 rather than having it be at the normal 10. That to me is actually not really very well discernible. If you look at the various kind of colorful cultural controversies and other things that have occurred and the kind of weird and awful things that people will always say after there's a major national tragedy, there are going to be some things that are already dialed up to 11 in the real world anyway. Mm-hmm. But the answer, Farah, is you represent it well and you understand that messy mix of emotions and emotionalism and sentiment and the like that's going to be there. That's part of the fire hose that people will drink from in our games.
This gets back to kind of where we began, which is thinking about what passes for thought exercises at the moment about what might be happening any day now, according to some reporting, or never, according to some other reporting. And the breaking out from, I guess the way that I've been thinking about this is, there is a version of the conversation that seems to be very theoretical and very kind of mechanical, which is, you know, well, we're only going to change one or two factors and we're just going to swap them out with matching parts and everything will carry on as before, just differently. We're not totally sure how it's going to turn out, but the polling says it won't turn out any worse than what we were doing before. And maybe there's an upside. That's sort of the level of that thinking mechanism. The other one, I may be being harsh here, but I think my kind of perception from the conversations I've been having both for the show and in preparation for episodes has been my sense of political campaigns is, you know, these are limited special purpose vehicles that are there to achieve a particular goal, winning, and that they do a lot of relying on what they regard as best practices or what worked last time or commonly held heuristics, and then it's just all systems go, roll the dice, see what happens. And that the kind of plan, to the extent that there is a plan, is always going to be a little bit just that, right? All right, we're swapping out the candidate, back to best practices, all systems go, spend the money, knock on the doors, hope for the best. I guess I'm not that kind of decision maker. And so instead, I'm sort of like, I don't know, don't you want to do some perspective taking? Don't you want to think about all the interchangeable things here? Don't you want to assess risks that are not the normal risks since we're now making things decidedly not normal? I'm curious, you know, if you were trying to design a game like this, what are some of the inputs or parts of the experience that you think, to the best of your knowledge and seeing what people have written about so far, had talked about so far, what's missing? What types of categories of things should they be thinking about in order to, I always use the term, the phrase sense and respond. There's kind of an implicit step in the middle there, which is think about it. But I think there's a real tendency to be blinkered when it serves you best or you think it will serve you best,
yeah.
and then react as opposed to respond. If I were them, I would want to get to sensing and responding as opposed to hyper-focusing and reacting.
So you mean specifically for an open convention?
Yeah.
What would be? Obviously, Farah, we had talked about this before when we connected to talk about how I would design a game like this. And the answer is you represent factions based upon what sort of interests would be at play there. To step back for a second and look at kind of what I would design, I would just try to design the convention.
Right.
I would have more teams than I usually like to have because there's so many different factions with an interest. All of them would consider victory through slightly different perspectives, and you'd have to represent that. This will be an array of actors, not just within the Democratic Party. For some, political chaos in the U.S. is a win. Mm. For some, having the Republican Party win the election would be a win for them. For others, pushing the Democratic Party to the left is a win on certain issues, regardless of the outcome of the elections. For others, getting the Democratic Party into the White House is a win. For others, having a centrist Democratic Party is a win. So you have all these different factions with different goals.
Mm.
I would represent different factions in kind of a timed gameplay. It would be a live game where time is compressed, but it's predictable when a few days go by. We probably would run it over the course of like the week or 2 weeks leading up to the convention, and we'd end it about 2 weeks out of the convention. That would probably be the time frame that we'd run it through. With, again, gameplay being compressed, it might be a 5-hour game.
Mm.
And we'd have all those different factions represented. So the way you would pick them is look at what has been an edge issue or an influential player and what they're after. So obviously, one thing that has divided the Democratic Party is the Gaza War.
Mm-hmm.
There would be a faction that would want the party to move significantly to the left and away from where Biden was. There's some intersection with the first faction I talked about, but there'd be the Sanders or squad wing of the party as one of the factions that exists within there. There'd be the DNC faction, mm-hmm. to give it a name, which would represent Paris, Biden. There'd be corporate interests at play. There'd be Republican Party interests at play. There'd be
crypto, bro.
Probably several. Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure for the Democratic Party if I would have them as an independent actor. Yeah, I'm sure that some crypto bros would come out to play, though.
Yeah, they always do.
But then you'd have factions representing the media, and maybe you have both independently mainstream media, conservative media, and maybe even more left of center media, all of which have somewhat of different interests in the campaign. You'll get foreign interests at play, and then let them loose and see what happens. It would be a refereed game. Every faction would pursue its interests, and we would see where things end up at the end of the game. That's how I would run it.
I think that's super interesting, especially one of the interesting things you can also do with running it as a convention is the party's conventions have rules committees. Did you ever do that? I did it in high school. It was the mock nominating conventions. Glencoe High School got to be the Democrats abroad. It was very exciting. We had no influence. sorry, Democrats abroad. But there's a lot of, to the extent that there is any real horse trading happening in conventions that there might be this year, there are nevertheless, you know, any kind of Congress of people sets up rules for how they want to operate and how they want to cast votes and, you know, when they want to schedule things. And there are subcommittees and those committees talk to other committees and so on. And all of those kind of structural things also create power levers. You can argue over the rules and see how that advantages each other. So it's not even just an expression of your political issue interest, but also how you're going to express it through the system. I love it. It sounds like a nicely designed chaos. You mentioned the kind of 5 hours. I also remember when we talked before, the idea of running multiple scenarios or running it multiple times and having some things switch out or change or just, you know, see how people adapt through that. How does that, I mean, maybe not in this particular context, but how does that work with the types of games you run doing it more than once?
Oh, it's inherent to the games. I mean, part of it depends on what you're trying to get out of a game. There are certain views that games are basically political science experiments, and so nothing should change from game to game. I don't subscribe to that. Generally speaking, there might be some games you run as a political science experiment. But in terms of our game design, we design them modularly. you know, there are different modules that can be taken in or taken out. We often iterate from one game to another. We're running a game in September at Georgetown University, which is actually a mashup of two of our games, the two games being Sleeping Giants and Arctic Awakenings. And it gave the name that I love of the mashup, which is Sleeping Awakenings, which I think is hilarious. What we get to do is, you know, use our games in part to test parts of a game we want to run down the road, to kind of see what resonates, to see how gameplay occurs, to see if people discern the clues that we've put out there, to see if they pull on the threads. And so we're always doing that. We're always iterating. We're always throwing in new scenarios. We have different scenarios that can be thrown into one game or another. A country collapse due to climate change induced pressures. There's a migration crisis. There's political effect from that. That's something that frequently will drop into different games of ours. Same thing for a convention game, right? Like, there's a lot of different things that you could drop into a convention game that would be unrelated to kind of the major point of the game. For example, what if there's an assassination attempt in the middle of the convention? Would that have a unifying effect? Would it have a divisive effect? How would the various factions respond? And what would play to their advantages? These are all things that you could ask and you could try. To me, the truth of a game tends to reside not in the outcome of a game, but rather in its internals. If a game is designed correctly and people are playing it well, then the kind of dilemmas that come across in the game and the kind of realm of the possible will mirror real life. One of the things that people who have worked on my gaming team for a while always are kind of amused by or point to is the way that oftentimes the real world down the road will track things that happen in our games. Yeah, which isn't surprising, right? They're analytic exercises they derive from subject matter expertise. So in part, this comes because we're correctly understanding trends and mapping them to the game. But things like, you know, Elon Musk just announced the move of a couple of his companies over to Texas. This is something that we'd had in a game we just ran in the spring at Duke University, much to the amusement of one of the people on my gaming team. Another random thing that our games got right was when Andrew Yang created his third party. Like, that actually was basically outright predicted in one of our games. So, like, things like that are fun and help to show that we're looking at some of these trends, right? To get back to your question, Vera, those could always be dropped in order to see how different factors mix things up, how teams react, and moreover, to playtest in advance things that we might want to make central to a game down the road.
This is also the part that I'm most interested in, and as you know, would love to actually do this game. But this intermediate steps are probably the more interesting thing to me. The outcome will be the outcome. The phrase everyone uses is the only poll that ultimately matters is the one that we have on election day. The other parts are more interesting because regardless of the outcome, some of those interim actions, decisions, reactions can affect the way a party, an organization, a culture emerges out of the experience. The kind of decisions that are taken along the way factions coalesce and form alliances or don't, can really give you a sense of what you should be trying to sense and how you should be thinking about your responses to the things that you sense along the way, if depending on what your goals are. Like the competition of goals, I think this is central. A guy I know worked on the Obama campaign in, I think, both 2008 and 2012, and his you know, sum up of what a campaign is for is to win elections. But to your point, that may be what the campaign is trying to do, but there are all of these other groups that are central to the success of the campaign that may have other interests, may have other desired outcomes, or at least have other acceptable outcomes. And then the question becomes one of, if the Democratic Party has been fractured, especially since 2016, what's the way forward? There seems to me, as an observer, to be a real risk of, you know, if the argument is that Trump broke the Republican Party and, you know, made a new thing out of it, I think there's a real risk that he slash the way the Democratic Party has run itself may break the Democratic Party too. And so if you were trying to hold it together or imagine a new emergent Democratic Party coming out of this experience, those interim steps seem like the more useful indices of what might be to come. If that's a full sentence, I'm not sure.
Yep, it's a great full sentence. And I think what we can say is just Look, I mean, here we're not trying to project. We're talking about a method.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. as a method, I agree. There's a lot big that's happening here with tremendous ripple effects. And to me, like, the answer is that this is a time when games can provide insight.
I think that's a really good place to start to bring the conversation to a close. And I'm just curious, Amal and David, if you were in a position to advise whoever the hell's in charge over there, where would you advise them to begin? I mean, apart from hire you guys and let's run a game.
So from inside the deep state, no one's in charge. No, I'm kidding. Humor's my coping mechanism. If I had to start somewhere, anywhere, I think I would identify the key influencers, put them into a room, and build a game for them. So that way they can learn how to communicate. Because if everybody's individually influencing from their own little part of the network, you're going to have a fractured and psychologically balkanized society, which is what we've become.
Mm.
So we get the influencers on some type of similar page, reading the same book, reading a book. Maybe we might be onto something, but that's just me right now.
I think also, Amal, you and I are probably agree that good luck getting any faction on the same page on anything.
Yeah. I mean, then they would have to agree, right? And then they would have to, in a way, abandon their platform, which is psychologically unsafe for some people. So
I actually would love to underscore your point, though. One of the things that I think both games and futurism have taught me is we often project out the future of being, you know, an extension of a trend that we're seeing now.
Mm-hmm.
But really, things kind of reversed and changed drastically in relatively short periods. That's one reason why in my life and career, I placed a strong premium on timeless value. But, you know, let's say you took the current social media climate and replaced it with one where there was a premium on civility. Like, let's say you'd get drastically different outcome in terms of what kind of speech is successful, what kind of comments get traction. You know, I'm not saying that we're going to kind of suddenly snap our fingers and that will be the universe that we're in, but often underlying assumptions will change in a significant way. And we've seen that happen on multiple issue sets in our lifetime. And we will see an acceleration of the extent to which you have massive reversals in terms of cultural assumptions or what seem to be dominant trends. Could go on about that, but I like Amal's answer so much. I just want to let it stand as speaking for us at Balance Games.
Well, thank you, Debbie.
I love both endings here, because I think even if we don't agree, having read the same page is beneficial. And I think the other thing that I love about this is it's both about shared awareness of each other's realities, if not a shared reality, but also some opportunity to imagine other futures, because I think we do tend to make decisions as if tomorrow will be like today, only more so. And so I think, yes, my hope is that serious people get into a room together and play serious games, because I think that will give them much better insight into how to proceed. It's not going to tell them what's going to happen, but it is going to give them, I think, an opportunity to just make better decisions as they encounter reality. So thank you both very much for having this conversation with me. I'm so grateful and can't wait to get the transcript.
Thank you so much, Farah. It was an absolute pleasure. And as I mentioned before, this is my first podcast interview as the CEO of Valens Games, and the first one that Amal and I have done together. It is a landmark for us.
Wonderful. Farah, this is absolutely wonderful, and much to a testament to David's like people collecting ability. I have yet to find someone that's not the most fascinating person I've ever met. And you are in that. So,
wonderful.
Would love to stay in touch.
Yeah, definitely. Let's definitely do that.
Crosstabs is hosted by me, Farah Bostic. Production by The Difference Engine and edited by me. Music from Audio Jungle by S Audio. Find us at crosstabspodcast.com, where you can subscribe to our weekly Substack, also available at crosstabspod.substack.com. Tell your friends about the show, subscribe on your favorite podcast service, and give the show a rating or review. I'd love to hear from you.
Email me if you have any questions, ideas for episode topics, suggestions for future guests, or want to talk about ways we can work together at Farah@crosstabspodcast.com. See you next time.